From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Organizing over decades of social justice causes, the legendary activist Lisa Fithian has been on the front lines of nearly every major movement, from the 1999 battle in Seattle to Occupy Wall Street and beyond. Now, in a new book called Simply Shut It Down, Lisa Fithian shares the wisdom she has gathered and the stories, often missed by the media, of how protest can stop illegitimate power in its tracks. Lisa Fithian's book is called Shut It Down, Stories from a Fierce, Loving Resistance. Welcome to the program, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure.
So I feel like anybody who has been an activist in the United States for long enough, in it, especially national movements, has probably encountered you or your work or one of your trainings or one of your workshops. I certainly remember from my activist days, being alongside you and seeing you in action. So it's really amazing in 2019 to see you putting all of this together in a book. Tell me what your goal was for this book. You're not an author, you're an activist, you're a doer.
Thank you for acknowledging that, because some people say you're an author. I'm like, yeah, but that's not what
I mean. You are an author now. I mean, now that you've published the book, you can't escape that. But in general, you're someone who takes action.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, part of it is like, I realized that I had a wealth of experience that was fairly unique, and that, you know, I had to pass it on. I just can't train all the people that need to, that could benefit from the lessons of all of our movements. And so, you know, I wanted it to be both, you know, tell the stories of our history. I wanted it to be a how-to, and I wanted to bring, you know, some of the important work around, you know, confronting oppression and healing also to the fore in this book. So I've tried to weave it all together best I can. And I feel pretty happy with it.
Let's start a little bit with your origins as an activist, because it's always inspiring and important for people who, for their own personal reasons, get drawn into activism. Many people get activated, if you will, at various points in their lives. And it might be, you know, people who were drawn to activism just when Trump came to power or when George W. Bush came to power. For you, it started even before George W. Bush, right?
It did, yes. It started for me in the 1970s when I was in high school. I mean, maybe a little before that, I tell the story in the book how my mother took me to a protest to try and get a streetlight. But really, it was when I was in high school, I got upset at what I thought was a lot of disrespect by some of the students. And it was a silly, silly thing about leaving trash in the cafeteria. But, you know, it was enough to spur me on to do an underground newspaper that was called The Freethinker. And that actually led to conversations at the school and some changes. And so I was like, wow, people can make a difference here. And as I became more active, I began to see that there was injustice around me. Again, at a local scale, we had we've lost our school budget and we're losing programs, and we organized and finally won that back. But I had those two really important lessons that people can make a difference. There's injustice, and then people organizing together can actually really change things and make a difference. Mm-hmm. And that has just kept me going my whole life, really.
And so this idea that you can actually make a difference is so critical, because when you talk to most people who are not activists, they may agree with you on the principles that you support. You may have that common language, but often a sense of powerlessness stops them from becoming active. What's, you know, it won't matter. In the end, none of it will matter, or you can't make a difference, or the powerful will win anyway. And your activism and the stories you've shared in this book have, every part of it is a counterpoint to that sense of helplessness, right? So what are some of, in the workshops that you do and in the trainings that you do, you share with activists how they can put wrenches in the machinery of power in a very basic way? I recall a lot of your work around direct action and civil disobedience, but those are tactics, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, direct action is really a strategy as well. Civil disobedience for sure is a tactic. And I actually say sometimes that direct action is a way of life. It's how we see the world. And I think that's really one of the most important things I do, is I help people, because we are socialized in this culture that is designed to take our power away. It's designed to actually have us feel like we can't make a difference. And so so part of what I try and do is help people understand that they do have power. They have even more power when they're connected to people that with them are collective power. And part of it is an organizing process, like to take little steps so people can get a sense of their power, feel that difference, and then, you know, they can go even more. So, for sure, direct action, Sonali, it's like when I was growing up, I was president of the student government in high school and college. People were like, oh, you're going to be president someday. You know, moved into doing legislative work. And I just realized that, yeah, there's a kind of power there, but there's a toxic power there. And that really, if we want to have fundamental change, we've got to be the outside force. So I really dedicated my life to being in the streets and raising up people power. Because when we exercise enough people power, those folks in the halls of Congress or the White House or whatever hall of power they're in have no choice but to move. And so that's basically what I've been trying to do, is just raise up generation after generation to be out in the streets and to do so strategically and in a way that's actually building community and relationships as we do it.
So that's really critical, because to be an activist requires much, much more than making a sign and standing on a street corner or even joining a large existing march. And a lot of the most effective organizing has a lot of strategy behind, a lot of thought put into how structures within the organizing can be built. So let's get into the nuts and bolts of that, because that's a lot of some of the training that you do. Some folks who got activated around Occupy Wall Street might remember this idea of affinity groups or consensus-based decision making. Tell me a little bit, and you have a section in your book that you call Horizontal Organizing 101. What is horizontal organizing, and why is it important?
Horizontal organizing is essentially network-based organizing. It's a way to view the work where we understand we're here to share power, and that we are no one person or one group is better or smarter than anybody else, but we are in a set of relationships, and that those relationships can be ever extended. So much of our social movement these days has been sort of carried out through the nonprofits, which are, I would say, more of a hierarchical model. And again, There's value in everything. This is not an either or, but we have to understand the differences. And in some of those hierarchical models, nonprofits, corporations, that's really the culture that we were raised into, where we think that somebody else has more knowledge, more wisdom, and should tell us how to do. It's the power of the boss, you know? And that's actually quite deadening for us human beings. And so network-based horizontal organizing is the process of really, another word for it is self-organizing, recognizing that people, and you see this in times of crisis a lot, people just do what needs to be done, right? They organize. Occupy was kind of like that. The rise up in Tahrir Square was like that. It's like people come together. It's like, okay, we need sanitation. Who's going to do that? Boom. Who's going to help bring food? Boom. Who's going to like make sure that there's security here, right? People self-organize, find with people with like interests. They start working together to actually do a job. And affinity groups are like that too. It's like a self-organized group of people that come together to support each other, to carry out actions, to be a place of emotional support, to be a place of political education. But one of the key pieces in all of this is that it's a place to engage in direct democracy. It's where we begin to make decisions about the things that affect our lives and about what we are going to do with our bodies in any given moment. We're not waiting to be told, go over here, do that, follow this sign. But we're like coming together and saying, you know what? These are my options. These are my choices. These are the consequences. I'm going to do this. And I'm prepared to assume the consequences of my actions, even if that means I'm going to go to jail or I'm going to lose my job or my home.
So mirroring the society that we want to create.
Exactly. That, I mean, thank you. Yes. Because that's what I think. It's like, we need an alternative to the society we're in. And I feel like these models are creating an embodied experience of alternatives for self-governance and meeting our basic human needs.
So the power of the state is often, what comes down full force whenever one successfully organizes. Any successful organizing movement knows that it has created change and made a difference when the power of the state comes down upon you to destroy what you've done. So knowing your enemy, if you will, to use a war term, how important is that? How important is it specifically to know the tactics of the police, who are often the ones deployed in the face of successful activism?
Absolutely. I know our movements are often criminalized and called violent, but it's really the police that bring the violence on. I think it's really important because the more powerful we get, the greater the pushback is going to be, both in the media and with the police. And the police have a license to kill. They have been slowly militarized over these past few decades. We know that they will not hesitate to use, from tear gas to what they call non-lethal weapons, which in fact can be lethal, to arrest large numbers of people, to violate our rights, knowing they're violating our rights. So we have got to, we've got to understand how they work. We have to train our eyes to pay attention to what they're doing, because what they do can help us inform what we need to do when we're in the moment in the streets. And it's a critical piece,
I mean, how critical is nonviolence when facing the police, not just for philosophical reasons, but for tactical reasons?
Right. I love your questions. Thank you. Because I am really much more what I would call myself a strategic nonviolent person. I feel like the question of violence and nonviolence is very complicated, and it's a historical debate in our movements. But what I do know is that in this place, in this time, in this country, we could never engage in an armed struggle that could counter the force of the weaponry and the political will to use violence against us. And if we understand that our power is in getting more and more people involved and out in the street, we have to work in a way where we are attracting them with beauty and love and joy, not with fear, right? The fear is the tool of the state, and they use it every day. And so I just think strategically it's critical that we are organizing in a way that, is bringing a culture of life, welcoming people in, creating a sense of belonging, and making sure that everybody understands that they have an important role to do in this work.
And the optics are so critical to these movements, because when our movements are amplified to the rest of the world, the images of police beating on protesters who are not fighting back has huge, huge potential to garner sympathy for your causes. And that was a massive lesson learned during the civil rights movement that carries on today, right?
Absolutely. And we saw it in Seattle during the WTO, when the police enact their own violence on people who are peaceful and nonviolent, and people see that, they know that this is not right. And so, yeah, it's the winning the hearts and minds. And when the police do harm, we start winning the hearts and minds of people in this country and around the world, quite frankly.
And the other aspect of dealing with police is the kind of, let's just say making it difficult for them to do their jobs. For example, what to do when arrested, how to make it as hard as possible for police to drag you away. I mean, those are some of my favorite, instances of the kinds of trainings that you have done to people. And those things are easy for anyone to learn, especially those who are willing to risk police brutality.
Right. And we call that non-cooperation, and it is part of the legacy of understanding nonviolent resistance work, which is that when we understand that the governments are able to continue to enact this harm, because at the end of the day, the vast majority of us cooperate and go along, that's how they get their power. But when we withdraw our cooperation, that's when we are taking our power back. And so understanding, again, the choices that we have, and that we don't have to do what they tell us to do all the time, and that we can actually work with each other to strategically non-cooperate by refusing to walk when they come to get arrested, because I don't believe any of us want to get arrested, Sonali, but we're willing to. And so, you know, it's the police that decide to arrest us, and I'm going to decide whether I cooperate or not. It's the police that decide they're going to process us, and I'm going to decide if I'm going to give my ID or information or not. You know, so it's the police that are going to give us terrible food. We can decide whether we're going to eat it or not and go on hunger strike. So all that is understanding that our choices are an exercise of our power, and they give us leverage to change the current conditions that we find ourselves in. And again, when we do it together and strategically, we can make a difference. Like in Seattle, 500 of us refused to cooperate. And we had thousands of people outside the jail holding space, you know, demanding our rights. So it was a different kind of inside-outside strategy, but collectively we waged a lot of power there. And while we didn't win all we wanted to, it went to courts, but we won in the courts. Mm. You know, hardly, most people in Seattle walked away without charges.
I'm wondering if you can reflect on the fact that you, in all of these conversations that we're talking about, of course, not everybody has the same privilege to be able to risk arrest by police. You consider yourself an anti-racist activist. You're a white woman. You've been involved in many causes around anti-racist activism over the years. And I'm wondering if you can reflect on that part of your activist legacy that you do talk about in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, particularly with the rise of fascism right now, like the rise of fascism and the collapse of the climate are the two core things. But anti-racist work has been key to who I am since the fact that I was born in Georgia, while I was raised in New York. Coming from the South, you can't escape the legacy of slavery. And so it's always been something that I've known has been essential to deal with. And I have just been on my own path of learning more and more over many decades, working very directly to be accountable with people of color when I'm working with them, and working really hard with white folks to undo their racism. And I work with a group in Austin right now called Undoing White Supremacy Austin, and we specifically work with white folks. And we work in the lineage of the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. They are my primary mentors. They're one of the only training groups I'd like to recommend to communities. They have been training people in Austin, where I live right now. We've been training thousands of people, including the city government and the police. And we've built, it's just really transformative when you can have a common analysis, a common definition. And, you know, it's like these systems and belief systems of oppression literally kill people, whether it's patriarchy or white supremacy, settler colonialism. This history was founded in that. And so if we want a different world, we've got to have different beliefs and different practices. And even economically, capitalism is just as equally harmful. So it's an essential part of my work. I don't go anywhere without talking about that now. And so now I'm actually doing a lot of work now with Extinction Rebellion, because I think it's a really important force. But it's a movement in the U.S. It's a lot of white folks. And so we're working very diligently to build relationships with indigenous leaders, to do anti-oppression work. Unlike every other country in the world, now they're changing. We put in a fourth demand around justice and reparations. So I just don't think that we can have the changes that we want without directly facing this legacy of socialization head on, and to take responsibility to doing our own work and building different relationships and really looking at those issues of access and privilege and power and equity. You know, we've come a long way on that front in this country.
And just for our audience, Extinction Rebellion is a climate change related organization or movement, originated in the UK, spread around the world. And in the UK, they literally shut down London for weeks and forced their political leaders to capitulate to their demands around climate and climate change. So, Lisa, your activism began decades ago, and throughout those decades, along with all the victories, we've seen illegitimate power take hold in many ways. And today you and I are talking in the era of Donald Trump. How, this is a time when, although there are many things that people can be thankful for in terms of resurgence of the left, sometimes it does seem like despair fills our news headlines. How do you, with your years of experience, face every day in the Trump era?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not easy, but I've just learned we have to deal with what's real. We have to feel the grief. We have to feel the pain and not try and tuck it away, to honor it and to use that to fuel our activism. I mean, it's stunning to me sometimes the daily assault that we face. But I do believe it is waking people up. The problem is there are not enough of us helping those people that are waking up figure out how to channel that emotional content, what they're feeling. So it's being real with what it is, and then also being strategic and knowing that, you know, when I read the People's History of the United States years ago, one of the lessons I took away from it is like, there's been a horrible history in this country. I mean, white supremacy existed long before Donald Trump, but we have an obligation to keep carrying it on, to keep organizing. Because every generation, new people are going to come in. They need to have, you know, follow in people's footsteps. They need the intergenerational relationships because, you know, the youth are our future. And together, you know, I mean, I don't know. What else are we going to do? We could just roll up and die. I'm not ready to do that. I care too much about this planet, the world, all living beings, and thank you to the great Sioux Nation and the work at Standing Rock, I have come to understand that I am a protector of all that I love. And so when I think of it in that way, it's easier for me to go forward because I'm very clear about what I'm doing and why I'm doing this. It's because I'm fighting for what I love. And I think that love is a great motivator.
And I'm wondering also what you make of the fact that one of the very satisfying things about doing social justice progressive work is that even when it seems like the whole power of the state is against you, eventually you find redemption and your work is vindicated. And that vindication is so important. I mean, years ago, you and others were fighting what was then called the anti-globalization struggle, right? The protests against the World Trade Organization and the World Bank and the IMF and critiquing global capitalism. Today, the World Trade Organization, the IMF, have in many ways come around to accepting those very critiques. The fight around Occupy Wall Street. Today, we have presidential candidates that are reflecting back those exact same terms that activists like yourself were shouting from the rooftops. That vindication is quite satisfying, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is. We don't always see the change we're making in the moment or the victories that we have. I think many of us know that we are working on that long arc of justice. And we basically, you know, honestly, though, I don't really know that the vindication, you know, I don't feel like I don't know. I'm just trying to think how I feel about that. It's like we're doing it because it's the right thing. And I guess maybe that is a good thing to say, Sonali. Like, it's good to see that what we have been fighting for has finally gotten through and people understand that it's a healthier way for everyone to go. So. Yeah.
So let's also talk a little bit about what you were saying earlier when we started this conversation, that you wanted to include in this book the importance of healing in our movements. Burnout is a very real thing. Despair is a very real thing. People who are in the movement can struggle with mental challenges because it's very, very hard work. It's debilitating. How have you come around to seeing that healing is an important part of activism?
Well, I think my point of entry on it really has been trauma. And knowing that I've been traumatized through this work and beginning to finally, you know, understand that I was acting out of trauma and was becoming very reactive, and that was not in my interest or anybody's interest around me. Also watching the toxicity that plays out in our movements and beginning to identify that this is a lot of people acting out of trauma. I mean, you can hardly live in this country without having been traumatized in some way at some point in time. And so it's essential that we have to do this healing work. And I think there's a lot more wisdom. I think it was really coming out of Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement really brought healing much more to the forefront in our movement understanding. And there's been a lot more wisdom around generative somatics. So it's starting to populate in our movements, this understanding that trauma is ever present and debilitating. And honestly, it's funny. I read this great book by Rezma Menenken called My Grandmother's Hand. And I took away from that that white supremacy I knew was traumatizing, but I didn't understand how it continued to benefit by us being traumatized. And so when I understood that it benefited and could continue by my being weak or immature or like not in my full power, I was like, I need to get stronger and heal myself and be more in my power, because that's one way in which I can stop this from continuing to carry on. So I'm integrating it in every way that I work right now, from how I'm working in groups, how we do openers, doing breath together, sharing a lot more gratitude and appreciation, taking time to move our bodies, bringing in song. Again, it's the foundation of building a culture of health and life that is so essential for us to be fully present and authentic and connected to one another. So it's just, it's a strategy for effectiveness, quite frankly, and for each of us to live in our full potential, and we'll create a much healthier culture.
Right. When we are healthy, our movements can be healthy.
Exactly. And I've been around a long time and I've seen a lot of unhealthy behavior, and we have to make some changes. Yep.
Yeah. Lisa, thank you so much for spending this time with me, for writing the book, and for all the work that you have done all these years, and I'm sure will continue to be doing. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. It's great to see you again. Thank you so much for the support.
My guest has been Lisa Fithian, longtime legendary activist who's engaged in decades of protest organizing, civil disobedience, and more for social justice causes. We've been discussing her new book, Shut It Down, Stories from a Fierce, Loving Resistance. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you, Lisa.